This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenzo. Case 163, Zwansha builds a seamless monument. The main case. Once Zwansha accompanied Zuifeng for a mountain walk. Zuifeng said, "I want to make this place my eternal home." Zwansha said, "Indeed, this place is well suited for a seamless monument." Zuifeng immediately made a gesture of measuring. Zwansha said, "That's all right, but I don't see it that way." Zhuifeng said, "How do you see it?" Zwansha said, "It's built." Zhuifeng said, "Good, good." The commentary. Since they're both from the same household, it's only natural that they indulge each other the way they do. But tell me, is there anything to what they say, or is this just two old monastics playing with mud balls? If you wish to see into this dialogue, you must first understand that within a single speck of dust, the whole earth is contained. When a single blossom opens, the entire universe arises. But before the particle of dust appears, before the blossom opens, how will you see it? Cut away all the complications and bring out your own treasure, and you'll see that there are originally no seams or gaps, not a single flaw or scar, and that each and every thing is perfect and complete, above and below, in front and behind. The capping verse. The field of longevity fills all of space. The seamless monument towers beyond the eye's reach. Breaking a jewel, each fragment is precious. Cutting sandalwood, each piece is equally fragrant. Zhuifeng was and Zwansha were teacher and disciple in 9th century China. And Zhuifeng was about 13 years older. And they died in the same year, in 908. And they were said to be almost like brothers in their closeness, and Zwansha helped Zhuifeng build his practice center before he set off to teach independently. And that's the way it's always been, you know. It's particularly clear in the beginning when it hasn't been built yet, or it's in the process of being built, that everyone who shows up helps to build that practice center and make it possible. As time goes on and things become more established, it appears that that's no longer true, but it's always true. You know, it's the law of entropy. If you stop building, it starts to fall apart. And so every day we are together creating this place of practice. And everyone who is here is part of that. They're taking a walk in the mountains. And Zhuifeng says, "I want to make this place my eternal home." You know, the sense of home is such a deep thing within us. If we're lucky, we grow up in a home, come of age in a home. We eventually leave home, and then we start looking for a home. And if we're lucky, we return home, not to the place of our birth, but a new place, a place that we never left. You know, how many people have come here, have I had conversations with over the years, who have, in coming here, said that it felt like home, felt like returning home. I had that same experience. And, of course, people say lots of things in terms of how they're, what their experience of practice and the Dharma in this place is, or wherever they might find themselves. But what's interesting to me is it's that word that keeps appearing over and over and over again. It feels like I'm home. And of course, from one side, that doesn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense to me. So I would have conversations with myself about that. It feels like I'm home. What do you mean it feels like you're home? That doesn't make any sense. And yet it was undeniable to me. I didn't know what that meant. I'd never had that experience before. I hadn't expected that experience. I didn't know, of course, I didn't know how things were going to work out. But that deep experience that I had every time I came was very real. And it was under my skin, because I remember on Sundays, because I was living about an hour away, I would come almost most Sundays, and I was with somebody. My partner at the time was shy, and so when we finished here in the Zendo, she would want to leave. She said, let's go. And I said, let's stay for a little bit. You know, let's have some lunch. And then she said, okay, now let's go. And I said, well, let's just hang around for a little bit. And what was strange to me about that is that wasn't really my kind of, that wasn't familiar. That wanting to hang around, you know, in a place that looked like there was a group assembling. That wasn't sort of my thing. And so the fact that I wanted to stay and linger was both felt very, you know, just natural. I felt that way, but it also confused me. I didn't quite get what was really going on. So in our normal life, you know, home is a place of, it's really the place of our identity. It's like the seat of our identity. It's where all of so much of that comes into being. The place where we live, the home, the house, the neighborhood, the you know, geography, the terrain, whatever that might be, whether it's a cityscape or a mountainscape, the people we share that space with, you know, all of that stuff becomes, and all the experiences we have there, that becomes, you know, becomes us, becomes our sense of who we are, that in a sense helps to form us and create the sense of who we are. And then as we get older, it more and more defines us, right? So what in the beginning is sort of soft and amorphous pretty quickly becomes fairly pretty thick-skinned and becomes more definitive. It's the place that, if we're lucky, supports us. But it can also be the place that limits us. And so it's interesting how, you know, so many of these great religious seekers, the Buddha, Jesus, left home and were very articulate about leaving home, about the need to do that, to leave that place that is defining and in that way confining. Because it's there that our identity is. You know, we all have the experience of, you know, we may feel like we're all grown up and, you know, leaping and bounding, or that we're, you know, free of all attachments, and then we go home, visit the family, and it's like, whoops. You know, how quickly, right, we can see ourselves, we can be seen, as that person. My sister, my younger sister, is 58, right? Which to me is like one of the strangenesses of the world, right? Because she's my little sister, right? That's who she is. She will always be my little sister, even when she's 80, right? And it'll just become more and more strange. Like there's just something wrong about that, you know. But the thing that we know or discover at some point is we have to leave home if we're going to find our way. We have to leave home. We don't have to burn it down, but we have to leave home to discover something new, something that is outside of that identity. And of course, within ourselves, you know, there are many homes that we leave home and then we just create new ones. And so we have multiple homes that we create, places that define us, that offer support, but also limit us. And that, most importantly, in terms of practice, become part of our definition. This is who I am. This is how I am in the world. This is how I'm seen. This is what I am. And the Buddha said all of those will come apart. They are coming apart in every moment. You know, and if we think about this in terms of any aspect of our life, any aspect of our identity, and how that aspect, so being, you know, having a profession, a teacher, a carpenter, a parent, you know, whatever, a monk, that career is dependent upon certain conditions, right? The Buddha said conditioned existence is dukkha. Conditioned existence being that which exists by things coming together and to bring it into being, right? And so you can't just appear as a teacher or a parent or as a monk. Things have to come together. Certain conditions have to be present in order for that to happen. And you also have to make certain choices, right? And so there's karma too. And each of those conditions that has to be present, right? So to be a monk, there has to be a tradition within which one can be ordained. There has to be an ordination teacher. There has to be a place in which one will be that monastic. There has to be the person who is going to be that monastic and all the conditions and circumstances of their life. And that each of those conditions, which are, let's call them limitless, too many to count, too subtle to know all of them, each of those conditions is also part of a vast network of conditions. So for this place to exist, right, what are all of the conditions that have to be, had to be present for it to come into existence, for it to continue to be in existence, for Dadarushi to find this place? So as we begin to really look, sort of drill down a little bit, we realize it's essentially infinite, the conditions. And that each of those conditions that everything is dependent upon are all impermanent, right? Are all in a state of both becoming and dissolution. They're the same thing. And so nothing that we call home in an ordinary sense can we keep. And so in that sense, everybody is always leaving home, or your homes are always leaving you as they manifest their impermanence. And so when we, as the Buddha said, when we rely on any or all of those to give us our sense of comfort or security or happiness, which they can do in some measure, right? Let's be clear about that. That they do give us aspects or experiences of comfort and security and happiness. But when we look to those to be provide us with the defining or the ultimate happiness and contentment that we all seek, we will be disappointed. Those that promise will be betrayed. We can also think of home in a more spiritual sense as, you could say it's where the heart is, but that could get very complicated in terms of what does that actually mean. Here, home is a place where there's no estrangement. There's no strangeness. There's no distance or separation. This home, you cannot arrive, you cannot leave, and you cannot stay. It is not a place. And yet, to bring that home to life takes place in a place. And so this home can't be lost. No one can take it away from you. It doesn't exclude our physical body, mind, our karmic body, you might say, but it's also, but it is not this physical body. In a sense, what is this path to realize self-nature, to awaken wisdom and compassion? Why? Right? Is it just some endeavor, just something to keep us busy, something to brag about? Is it an abstract philosophical thing? Or is it for the purpose of finding our home? Which is spoken of in so many, to understand this life. What is this life? To understand who we are. Who am I? How do I live this life? Is it just about accumulating? What is it? And that experience of estrangement, which seems universal and historical all the way back, you see it seems to be given voice in every spiritual practice, every religious tradition, the recognition that there is some sense of alienation. Somehow we have been cut off from something essential. That sense of being in our lives, going through our lives, but somehow not in it, not in contact. Something's in between. And estrangement means to alienate or to be alienated, to treat as a stranger or to be treated as a stranger, a sense of foreignness or strangeness. And so, of course, you know, what we're met with when we come into Buddhist practice, wanting to know, why is my life not working? The question we're met with is, how are you working? What is your inner working? And so to begin to address that alienation, that strangeness, that foreignness within ourselves. And so ultimately we realize there is no strangeness, no gap, no distance, no alienation, nothing to be alienated from. That sense of that is what we call delusion. And that sense could be so deep, so tangible, seemingly intractable, so shared, would seem to, you know, be a sign that it's true. It must be true. That must be the way things are. Or is it just a universal aspect of human consciousness, human nature? And that every person in their own way, every path in its own way, is trying to guide the seeker home. And it's in that lack of strangeness, that coming home, that really compassion arises. That we've learned necessarily, we have to have learned it within and towards ourselves, but then it extends and becomes much larger. And where that compassion or that love, it's a great love, it's the love of the Bodhisattva, isn't based on shared stories or mutual interests or, you know, the normal stuff. It's just great love. And it's not restricted to people or kittens and puppies, you know. That in the beginning, in an almost inexplicable way, in a way that we don't yet understand and yet cannot deny, we begin to experience that towards all directions. Every session, that's given voice to, where people speak about a feeling of connection or affinity or love for everyone in the room, knowing full well that they don't know everybody in the room. Perhaps hardly at all. And that doesn't seem to matter. And so Zhuo Feng said, I want to make this place my eternal home. So what's that about? How can anything that is made be eternal? Right? This is not possible. Everything that is made must come apart. I just spoke about it in terms of it being conditioned. So what does he mean, eternal? Self-nature is eternal because it's not constructed. That's why it's so hard to realize, right? It's easy to put our finger on things that we make because we make them, right? So however we make them, with whatever sense organs we use, that's the way that we can touch it. We can recognize it. We can see its object nature. But how do we make contact with something that was never made? I want to make this place my eternal home. And Zwanzu says, indeed, this place is well suited for a seamless monument. And so think of that, a monument or a temple, right, that has no seams. Right? Now, everything that's put together, a pair of pants, a book, a temple, is going to have seams, right? Where this wall joins that wall, where the window meets the edge, right? Where roof meets sides. Here, it has no seams, which means it can only be made as one, it is one complete unity, one entity. Well, what kind of thing is that? It's seamless, he says. There is no place for things to have been brought together or for them to come apart. And so Zhuo Feng said, immediately began making a gesture of measuring. What is he doing? How would he build it? How would he build it so that it's seamless? It's like building a house in empty space. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, the Buddha, before Vimalakirti arrives on the scene, the Buddha has a chance to say a few words. And he talks about a Buddha field. And he said, a Buddha field, which is a seamless monument, is a field of bodhisattvas, of living beings. And the extent or the reality, the fact of that Buddha field, of that the existence of that Buddha field, is equal to the degree within which the bodhisattva who lives in that Buddha field is helping to serve other beings. They're the same. And so when the bodhisattva acts on behalf of others to alleviate suffering, to bring forth patience, to make an offering, to soothe a troubled heart. To that degree, that Buddha field comes into being. And then the Buddha says, if you would like to build in this space, in this Buddha field, because it's empty, you might go ahead and do that in spite of the fact that it's not possible to build or to adorn anything in empty space. How can you build something in empty space? He said, in just the same way, he said, but nevertheless, you can go ahead and do that. In just the same way, a bodhisattva who knows full well that all things are like this empty space wishes to build a Buddha field in order to develop living beings, she too can go ahead and do this, in spite of the fact that it's not possible to build or adorn a Buddha field in empty space. And so then he goes on to say, and as you build this, there are certain things that you should make sure are present, like positive thought, high resolve, virtuous actions, the paramitas, generosity, the precepts, patience, and so on. And so although it's not possible to build this seamless monument, Xuefeng immediately makes the gesture of measuring. What is this all about? We too are, every day, with every session, building a seamless monument. And everywhere you look, you see it. It is this mountain. It is this magnificent building. It is you and me. It is this hall. It is Urioki. It is face-to-face teaching. Building and adorning, making powerful and beautiful in empty space. How can we understand that? It's here now. This is how we can understand it. It's here now. Zhuangzi said, that's all right, but I don't see it that way. Xuefeng said, how do you see it? And Zhuangzi said, it's built. Why go about measuring? It's built. Xuefeng said, good. Good. When we encounter and reflect on emptiness, we should really be careful, meticulous in examining any ways, obvious or subtle, in which we understand that or think that that means that things don't matter or aren't important, that pain and suffering isn't real, that this isn't happening, that you are not a part of it, and have a contribution to make. For something to matter, it doesn't need to be independent, autonomous, permanent. It doesn't need to be possessed. It doesn't have to be bought and sold, fought over, attached to. It doesn't have to bring forth emotion, although it can. In our confusion, we mistake attachments for love, for caring, for compassion. Think of the Buddha, right, who lived his whole life committed to the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Right, a life permeated, I don't know if you can say permeated by non-attachment, that's a little, seems a little odd. Right, an expression of non-attachment. And yet, wholly devoted. He says, in the commentary, Dadarishi says, if you wish to see into this dialogue, first understand that within a single speck of dust, the whole earth is contained. The whole earth is contained. Master Dogen, in the fascicle I was reading from the other day, said, those who understand a speck of dust understand the entire world. Those who master one thing, master myriad things. Those who do not master myriad things do not master one thing. Because those who study mastering see myriad things as well as one thing through penetration, seeing into, through. Those who study a speck of dust simultaneously study the entire world. And this is essentially how we examine the whole of our lives in a single moment. In a single moment, there is that moment. It might be filled with the breath, or with a feeling in your knee, or with an emotion, or a thought, or a memory, or silence, or not knowing. And in that moment, that one speck of dust contains the whole world. And when we study that one speck of dust, we're examining, peering into the whole world. Of course, we don't see it that way in the beginning, because the whole world is a very large place and rich with diversity. And so it takes time to see and understand what that is, that truth that has been spoken about not just by Buddhist masters. And so when we study one thing, we're studying the whole world. Now, that doesn't mean that an enlightened being, you know, that if you realize yourself, then suddenly you know microbiology and you can speak Portuguese, you know, and fly a helicopter. It doesn't mean that. Those are considered minor powers. The great powers that it gives us insight into is the mind and everything that is mind, which is the whole universe. And so when we sit in our zazen and see and develop the capacity to truly see clearly, without obstruction, what appears, and then in complete acceptance, right? Not fighting. And then to release, because letting go is to release a grasp, right? The activity is already happening, the grasping, or the energy that's moving into that when something arises, particularly if the mind starts moving, judging, that grasping is taking formation. The muscles are tightening. And so letting go means releasing that energy. That's why wakefulness and relaxation are so important. That when you relax within your body in an upright posture of the Buddha, you're manifesting your body as a mountain that is at ease. And then we redirect our attention back to that speck of dust, the breath. A koan, awareness. And to understand, you know, because as we start to see the myriad streams of our delusion and our karma and our attachments, you know, if you start to take an inventory and you think, okay, I'm going to have to work through these things one by one, it's like, you know, overwhelm sets in, right? I remember going into Daido once and saying, you know, this is never actually going to work in this lifetime. Like, I've run the numbers, you know? And it's like, I'm not going to live long enough, even in the best of circumstances. And he just smiled and shook his head. And now I know why. Because he had heard that over and over and over from different people, just as I have. And so what I didn't understand, what we don't understand, is that one speck of dust contains the entire world. So when one thing is examined, when one you release one in one moment, it's not just one thing. right? When you take up one aspect of your life that needs to be attended to, it's not just one aspect. Nothing is divided, right? When you develop or take care of some aspect of your zazen, so you haven't really been paying attention to your posture, so you start doing that, right? You realize, oh, that matters, actually. Who would have thought? And so you start to pay attention to it, right? On a more subtle level, and you start to find that ease, and you really start to take to heart, oh, I need to actually relax. I'm not going to blast my way through this. And then how surprised you are when you see how that extends beyond what you call your physical body, right? Beyond the physical. That one thing is not just one thing. So forget the numbers. They don't apply. And in order to do this, to take this responsibility to build this seamless monument in empty space, we have to want to. And I spoke about this the other day. This is the realm of positive thought that Vimalakirti is talking about. It's bodhicitta. It's in every vow. It's expressing a heartfelt desire. It's the four immeasurables. It's an expression of the recognition of how, of the faith we have in this world and in ourselves as human beings and our capacity. And it's an expression of a dedication to that. And so that desire, that's why we express those desires over and over and over again to strengthen them, to let them really get in deep so we really mean it. I want this. And that I want this without clutching. Right? I want this not like all the other things I've wanted. I have to go about this a different way. And that when we do this within ourselves, because one speck of dust is the universe, because one mind is mind, you know, that when we honestly practice, you know, an honest practice can often look very rough from the outside, right? It can look like struggling. It can look like dukkha. But when we engage that, that's honest practice. And that when we do that with our mind, with our thoughts, with our emotions, with our reactivity, with our judgments, with all the things that bind, we're gaining understanding and insight and, very importantly, compassion. And so that when we exceed those things in other people, other people's judgments, right, other people's youthful attachments to the Dharma, which can happen in any stage of life. But you know what I'm talking about. You know, it's the romance. In other words, we see things that might offend, or someone's righteousness, right? They've encountered the Dharma, now everyone has to encounter the Dharma. We see that, and they're not so offensive. Right? They don't really bother us, because we know that mind. We know that way of being. We know what it feels like. We know how true it is. We know the kind of intoxication of that. And we also know that if that person is practicing honestly, they'll find their way. They'll find their way, just like you did, are. And that's an incredible thing to offer someone. You don't have to move a muscle just to know that. It changes how we are with each other. That's a manifestation of compassion. And it doesn't mean that we can't offer help where help is needed, just like we have been offered help. But that we know that we don't neither condemn them for it, nor try and take it away from them. They will find their way. And for me, that's one of the incredible things about training, is that you are trusted that much. You know, in moments of confusion and floundering and, you know, which side is up and, oops, sorry. Sorry I just did that to you. Right? Nobody makes their way through training without leaving a little bit of carnage. I mean, mildly put. Right? Not dead bodies, but, you know, some cuts, bruises, you know, slights. I mean, I can tell you some stories. Because we're doing this live. It's live. And you don't get to work it all out in advance. You don't get to get yourself all presentable before you present. It doesn't work that way. And so, and that's the tempering, you know, the refining, the polishing, the smoothing, the calming of this is that we do it together, and we will need to ask for each other's patience a lot. And we will need to grant that to each other a lot. That's one of the extraordinary things we can do for each other. Dharoshi says, cut away all the complications and bring out your own treasure and see that there are originally no seams or gaps, not a single flaw or scar, and that each and everything is perfect and complete, above and below, in front and behind. And that is true at every step while we're finding our way. It's true in the moment when I step on your toes, when you step on my toes. It is true then. And having faith in that, having faith in Buddha nature, and having faith in our honest practice, honest in the sense that, you know, you have to learn how to fall because you're falling. You have to learn how to get up, because having fallen, you need to get up. And that we do that together. And in that, that's resilience. That's having left home and finding your home. And it has to arise from a deep desire and faith. I mean, what makes you think you can do this anyway? That's kind of bodacious, right? For you to think that? No, not really. Not trusting, that's bodacious. Doubting ourselves, what's that about? Right? Who told you that? How do we buy into that? Trusting ourselves, that's kind of the normal thing in terms of our inner workings, in terms of how the world seems to work, pretty much on a basis of trust. Trees to wind, sun and moon, rain and stream bed. And when it, you know, when the storm steps on the mountain's toes, the mountain has to regain its balance, right? Stream beds overflow, roads flood, stuff happens, right? Being in harmony doesn't mean that it always looks harmonious. But in every moment, the mountain is responding. This is what responding looks like, that flood. What does this look like as we're finding our way, as we are practicing and bringing forth our own wisdom? The field of longevity fills all of space. The seamless monument towers beyond the eye's reach. That's how vast and wide you are. Breaking a jewel, each fragment still precious. Cutting sandalwood, each piece utterly fragrant. It's not about size. It's not about whole or broken in our ordinary way of looking at things. And so we have to discover the way of looking at things, which is as they are. And so when we really, if we can trust that, then when we see our mind building, not a temple, not a seamless monument, but a seam-ridden monument in our minds, right? That's not a place of faith. That's not a place of trust. That's not a place of compassion. And so we find our ground. We turn in to this seamless monument. Because it's so close, it's difficult. And because what is close is not like anything. And so it's difficult to see. But not seeing it is just our current state of awareness. That's all. There's no wall with any depth. There's no barrier with any dragons. The seamless monument. So as we move into this latter portion of Sesshin, you know, our ordinary mind starts to prepare our next move, right? What's your next move? Dinner on Sunday night? Movie? You know, so recognize what this is about is this, now. Because if we can't practice this now, then when you're sitting down to dinner on Sunday night, you're not going to be there either for that. And it's always just one dream ahead of the next. And so really appreciate that, right? That this is part of Sesshin, the discipline, is to hold your space. Stay on your seat, right? Because you're training yourself to be that very thing. Live where life is taking place. Allow that. Give yourself that. What greater gift?
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.